Wanted to discuss this morning is a little bit about the labor shortage. All of us are well aware that there's a major hiring crisis here in the United States, and I heard that it's all over the world. And the question is, if we are business owners, how are we to go about hiring the right candidate for the job? Now, obviously, you have to find the person who is most suited for the job, but is there anything that the halacha has to say about what the criterion may or may not be for who is supposed to be hired, where we're supposed to be shopping, who we're supposed to be patronizing? That's what we're going to discuss this morning. And I think it will take us into a fascinating area of history as well that goes back to the days of the Rambam. And for about 150 years after the Rambam, this was a major, major debate and an interesting discussion. So we begin with Rashi in Parshas Bahar. And this Rashi brings a passage from the Medrash in the Torah's Kohanim. Very interesting that this Medrash is not found in the Gemara. Usually you go through the Gemara and you find all of the different halachos that are relevant to our day-to-day life, to Choshen Mishpat, to Evan HaEzer, to Yerudea. Everything can be found in the Gemara. And here you have what would seem to be a very important halacha, but it is not quoted in the Gemara itself. The only source that we have is what Rashi quotes from the Torah's Kohanim. Rashi is commenting on a pasuk in Parshas Bahar, where the Torah says, O kano miyad amisecha. And we're not exactly sure what that means. And Rashi there quotes the Medrash that says, Kisha atam mocher. If you are going to be involved in a business, and you're going to be selling an item, lo timchar ela la amisecha. You should make sure that you sell the item to amisecha, means one of yours, one of your contemporaries. Shenemar v'chisimkru memkar la amisecha. And the Torah means to teach us that I should sell the item to a Jew as opposed to a non-Jew. Now, that's going to be very problematic because if I run a store, what are you going to say? Everybody who walks in, I have to ask them, are you Jewish? Are you not? Oh, if you're not Jewish, you can't shop in the store. How can we discriminate like that? If I'm a doctor and I have patients that are signing up to come in, I should say, well, only the patient who's Jewish I'm willing to take, but anybody else I can't. That can't be what the Medrash means. We know that that's not the case. So what exactly do we mean here is something we're going to have to see. But Rashi certainly quotes this passage of the Medrash, and it is not only Rashi on Chumash who writes it, it is the Sefer Achinuch who discusses this as well. Many other Rishonim quote it as well. The Rambam even writes, and he extends this beyond buying and selling. The Rambam says, not only if I own a business and I'm going to sell something, or if I'm going to buy a car, or I'm going to buy a house, I should buy and sell from and to a Jew, as opposed to a non-Jew. The Rambam takes it a step further, and he says it goes also with regard to the hire that I choose to make. As we started, there's a major hiring crisis. There's a labor shortage here in the United States, and the question is, who am I going to hire? So the Rambam says, you have to think about this point when you're going to look to hire someone as well. And the Rambam says, in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. Now this is, Hilchos Matnas Aniyim is better known to all of us as the laws of tzedakah, what we're supposed to give to the poor. So the Rambam says, Shmona Milos Yesh L'tzedakah. There are 8 different levels that go in ascending order as to what is the greatest, what is the most noble way that a person can give charity. The Rambam says, Maila gedola she'en la maila mimena. What is the highest, most honorable way to give charity? The Rambam says, Zeh machzik biyad Yisrael shamach. If you have a Jew in your community who has been completely depleted of his assets, who is totally destitute, and you go and you are machzik biyad Yisrael, you go and you hold his hand. Now what does it mean you hold his hand? Obviously, he needs emotional support, but the Rambam here is referring specifically to you strengthen him by giving him an investment. V'nosinu matana or halva. You give him either a gift and you say, this is yours and I want you to get back on your feet, or you give him a loan and you tell him that the intention of the loan is that you hope he'll be able to get back to where he's supposed to be. Or the Rambam says, Osa imo shutvas, you make a partnership with him and you say, you know, I believe in you and I believe that you can be a partner of mine in business. I believe that something good can come out of this partnership, and you make him feel like a mensch by doing that. Or the Rambam says, best of all of that is if you make him self-reliant. Mamtzi lo melacha, you find him a job. Kedei lechazek es yado ad shelo yitztarach lebrias lishol. The greatest, says the Rambam, is I find this person a job, and therefore they won't have to go and ask from others any longer because they're going to be self-reliant, they're going to be self-sufficient. That would be, in one way, says the Rambam, actually the highest way, to give someone charity. It's very nice to give of ourselves, it's nice to give a donation, to give a gift, but even better than that is if I can put the person on his own 2 feet and allow them to be able to move forward on their own. So this is what the Rambam says here, and he tells us that We have an obligation that when hiring people, when looking to give someone a job, we should try to give that job to a Jew, based on this pasuk as well, where the Rambam basically teaches us that the pasuk is telling us not only that should we be doing business, interacting, selling, buying to a Jew and from a Jew, but we should also be doing hiring to a Jew and not really focus our attention on a non-Jew. Now, obviously, anyone who has a business knows that you have Jewish and non-Jewish employees. So we're going to have to discuss this a little bit. We have a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. A Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us, "V'hayu aniyim b'nei beisecha." It sounds like it's more of a Musar idea. "V'hayu aniyim b'nei beisecha" means I should have an open home, and I should allow all kinds of different people into my house, and I shouldn't try to only stick to a certain echelon of society. I should have aniyim in my house as well. Obviously, that's a very important thing for all of us. But the Rambam takes it a little bit further, and he says, it's not referring to who sits around my table. It does not mean that when I'm making the guest list for every Shabbos or Yom Tov, who's going to eat in my house, it does not mean that I should only pay attention to the aniyim or only the ashirim. Obviously, that's very important. But beyond that, the Rambam says that the Mishnah is teaching us something extremely important, and that is, if you're going to have a worker who you're considering to have come work in your house, the Rambam says, "V'hayu aniyim b'nei beisecha." You should choose that somebody who actually needs the job, somebody who needs the parnasa, should be the one to do the work in your house, as opposed to somebody who already is doing fine. The Rambam says that would be part of what the instruction of this Mishnah is. Aniyim b'nei beisecha doesn't just mean I should be nice and kind and invite them over for a meal. It goes way beyond that. It means I should have that person take a job. I have to say that I have a family relative who, Baruch Hashem, is in a very good financial state. And I've always been extremely impressed by many of the things that go on in their home. But one of the things that I've seen that it's just so powerful, it's so amazing. And I mentioned to them this Rambam where he explains the Mishnah. There are a lot of people in their particular community who don't have a good parnasa. A lot of people in our community also who don't have a good parnasa. And this family has basically hired these individuals to be doing different kinds of jobs for them that are not even necessary. They've made up jobs to make the person feel like they have a purpose in the world. So one of the people they knew in the neighborhood really didn't have a job, and because of that was getting depressed, and as a result of that was not waking up in the morning, leading to a whole lot of other things. You can't even get yourself started on the day if you have no reason to wake up. So this family decided to ask this individual that he should be the one to go to the bakery every day and buy baked goods for all of their children who live in a mile radius of the parents. And every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, this man does his job faithfully. He wakes up early. He has a purpose. He goes to the bakery. He buys the baked goods. And you know what happens right after? It all goes in the garbage. They don't eat any of it, or they give it away to whatever it is. Nobody eats it. Nobody needs it. But this man feels like $1 million. He gets paid to do his job. He wakes up in the morning. He can have a successful day. All because we're thinking, "V'hayu aniyim b'nei beisecha," because we're thinking how we can give a job to somebody who is actually an ani. How can we help somebody who can be encouraged by my belief in them that they can actually do something and have purpose in their day? And the Rambam writes this in Hilchas Matnas Aniyim as well. Let's see the Rambam in number Gimel, where he says, "Tzivu chachamim, shiyu b'nei beiso shel ha'adam aniyim v'yisomim b'makam ha'avadim." I can have a housekeeper, I can have somebody come and do the paint and fix the toilet and do all the things that need to be done. But if I have an option to either call a professional or to call somebody who knows how to do the job equally as well, but may not have as good a reputation or may not have the credentials that I'm looking for, says the Rambam, it would be a very wise idea to give the opportunity to the ani, to the yasom. It doesn't mean that every yasom should be pitied. It means if you have a yasom who needs help, then obviously we should help them. If you have a yasom who doesn't need any help, that's not what the Rambam is referring to. Mutav lo lishtamish be'elu v'yenu b'nei Avram v'yitzchak v'yakom minachasav. Says the Rambam, I should try as best as I can to allow the children of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov to benefit from the money that God has blessed me with. If I just pack my house with servants and housekeepers and everything, that's not going to bring about a good result. On the other hand, if I allow aniyim to come into my house and to do whatever needs to be done, mosiv zechuyos u'mitzvos, that will add merit, that will add a zchus for myself. Now, what's interesting is, it seems from here the way the Rambam formulates this, is that it's not an absolute obligation. When I'm buying, when I'm selling, when I'm hiring, it's not an absolute obligation. It seems that this is just a part of the mitzvah tzedakah. It seems that this is just a Maisa of Derech Eretz. It's a nice way, it's a Musar statement, and in fact, the way that the Medrash quotes this in the Psikta is Limda Torah Derech Eretz. The Torah is telling you, what's the nice way to live life? What's the right way to hire an employee? The way the Rambam says it over here is mutav. It's a nice idea. If I have option A or option B, mutav. It's a nice thing to do this. He doesn't say chayev. He doesn't say you're absolutely obligated. And the way the Torah quotes it as well when he discusses this halacha is v'yachshav lo litzdaka. The Torah says, if you try to prioritize in this way, and you try to give a parnasa to somebody who's a Jew, and to take them out of their state of destitute in a situation like that, the Torah writes, that will be yachshav lo litzdaka. However, the way the Ramah, as we'll see in a minute, the way the Ramah formulates this, it seems that the Ramah believes that this is an absolute obligation. When I'm going to give somebody a parnasa, when I'm going to choose where I should buy, where I should sell, who I should patronize, it is not just an Eitzah Tova. It is not just a Midas Derech Eretz. It's not just a Musar point. This is an obligation that we have, says the Ramah, and that's what I want to get into in a couple of minutes. Now, let's look at a Gemara Maseches Bav Metzia. The Gemara here is a very important source for this whole topic, where the Gemara tells us in Daf Ayin Aleph Amid Aleph, we all know that there are individuals who are in a position where they're able to give loans to others. We all know there are other people who are in a position where they need to take a loan from someone else. So here, the Gemara says, what happens? Im kesef talva esami, esha'ani imach. We know that when you have somebody who's in a position to give over a loan, there's a major difference between loaning the money to a Jew, loaning the money to a non-Jew. What's the difference? Ribbis. So we have a prohibition of charging ribbis. You're not allowed to charge interest when you give a loan to a Jew. However, it says clearly in the Gemara that when you're giving a loan to a non-Jew, you'd be allowed to charge ribbis, and you would be allowed to take ribbis. That's the way it goes. That's the way it is. That's the relationship. So here, the Gemara tells us, what happens if I have a bank? A bank is probably not a good example because there are federal regulations or whatever it is. But say, argument's sake, I have a lot of money and I'm able to give it out and I'm happy to lend out money to people. It's not a problem at all. So now I have the opportunity to do that. And I have Ami Vinachri Ban Lalavos. I have two people who walk into the bank and each one of them wants a loan. Now we don't have sufficient funds to give both of them. If we have enough, of course we should give both. But what if I don't have enough? I only have $50,000. Each one of them needs a $50,000 loan. So I should either give it to the Jew who is here, or I should give it to the non-Jew. Says the Gemara, I should give it to the Jew first. Again, if I have enough money, I'll give both. Of course, why not? I should help everyone. But let's say I don't have enough money. I have to make a prioritization. Should I give it to this person, or should I give it to that? So the Gemara says I should give it first to a Jew, as opposed to giving to a non-Jew. What if one of them is wealthy and one of them is poor? So the wealthy person wants to take his business to the next level and he needs the loan. The poor person simply needs to take care of day-to-day needs. So the Gemara says, there's a priority there also. Ani kodem. The poor person comes first because he needs it more. Aniye ircha v'ani echa. What if I have somebody who is from my city or somebody who is from my family? So then my family comes first. What if I have somebody who is a ani from my city or an ani from Eretz Yisrael? So as much as I feel bad for both of them, I have to make a priority somehow, so I'm going to take care of the one who lives in my community. Fine. Ask the Gemara, isn't that obvious? I have a Jew and a non-Jew who come to take a loan. Of course I should give the Jew first. Why does that even have to be discussed? And the Gemara answers, what it means is, even though I'm going to suffer a loss by giving it to the Jew, why am I going to suffer a loss? Because I can't charge the interest. Had I given the loan to the non-Jew, I would have gotten $60,000 back because I would have charged him interest. Now that I'm giving it to the Jew, all I'm going to get back is the money that I put in, $50,000. So maybe I would say, yeah, it's nice to be a good guy and to give a loan to whoever needs it. But if I have the opportunity to make money by giving it to the non-Jew, and now I'm going to lose the money by giving it to the Jew, maybe you would say I don't have an obligation. From here, says the Gemara, I have to be willing to take the loss of all of that interest money and give the loan to the Jew as opposed to the non-Jew.
You know, you lend the money to a wealthy person,
yeah,
as opposed to a poor person. You know, I'm not going to get the money back, but I will get back. Forget about the interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you know you're not going to get it back, someone once told me, don't ever lend anyone money if you're not willing to lose all of the money that you gave them. Okay, so I'm not in a position to lend anyone money anyway. But if you know you're not going to get it back, then you're not mechuyev to give. That's not a loan. That's giving a matana. That's giving a gift. We're talking about where there's a protocol set up, direct deposit. There's a way that you know you're going to get it back. You can prosecute. You can get it back. Whatever. It's insured. You're going to get it back. So that situation actually is an interesting discussion in one of the Achronim. The Shvus Yaakov has a discussion whether or not if I own a business and I am now paying workers, can I take money from my Miser account and pay my Jewish workers from the Miser money? Because after all, when you look here in the Rambam, it seems the Rambam says it's a mitzvah of tzedakah to hire a Jewish worker. So I had option A to hire a Jew, option B to hire a non-Jew. This would be amazing, right? I make $1 million a year. I put, 10% of that away in my Miser and my tzedakah account. Now I'm going to take from my tzedakah account, I'm going to pump it back into the business because I'm not going to have to do the payroll by paying my employees. So the Shvus Yaakov says, that's ridiculous, it doesn't work. Of course, the Rambam's saying, it's a nice idea, it's tzedakah, it's a very noble thing to do, to give a job to a Jew as opposed to a non-Jew when there are two people who need it and are equally qualified. But at the same time, you can't then say that I'm going to give my Miser money, my tzedakah money, to pay my payroll. However, Reb Chaim Kanievsky writes in one of his Svarim, he has a sefer on the Rambam and Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, and there he points out that although it's true the Shvus Yaakov writes that you would not be allowed to give your payroll from the Miser account, however, he says, if let's say I'm paying this person more only because I'm trying to be nice to them, trying to get them off their feet. So yeah, the payroll, obviously every other employee with the same kind of job, with the same kind of position, I have 10 secretaries in the office. Everybody's making $50,000 a year. I want to try to help this person, so I give them $60,000 a year. Says Reb Chaim Kanievsky, there's no doubt that the extra $10,000, of course, can come from your charity account because it's not something I had an obligation to give. So now, I just want to turn to a fascinating time in Halacha where there became a major issue about this conversation about prioritizing Jewish businesses over a non-Jewish business. And this really dates back to what I believe is a very, very dark period in Jewish history. It's a terrible story. You know, sometimes we look around our community and we say, oh, there's so much machlokas, and it's so terrible. And again, machlokas is always terrible, and it's never a good thing, and we should never be proud that there's machlokas going on. So, yes, we had the Vada Kashrus issue, and everyone was fighting, and everyone was screaming, and I believe in this, and I believe in that, and nobody even knew any of the facts. But whatever it is, people were getting very involved in writing articles and attacking each other, and it was terrible. It was very painful. But you think about how people used to fight in the days of the Rishonim, this like pales in comparison. It's crazy. It's crazy what used to go on. So let's see. I want you to just be introduced to a famous dispute, a famous debate, and it's something that's probably very foreign to us. You know, one of the most basic, fundamental svarim, a staple of every Jewish library, has to be the Rambam. The Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah, but what's interesting is at the time that it was written, it was so controversial. And there were so many great gedolim at the time who were opposed and they resisted the publishing of the Rambam. And in fact, they resisted it to the point that they put the Rambam in Cheirim. So let's hear what's going on here. Let's go into this a little bit. This is in the 1300s. And this dispute lasted around 100 years at the time that the Rambam was publishing it. It trickled down. It took a break for about 50, 100 years. And then it started up again in the days of the later Rishonim, about what their feelings of the Rambam actually were. So the story goes that the Rambam decided to write a monumental work to try to, it's an outstanding work, to try to streamline all of the halacha that anyone will ever have to know. And if you look through the Gemaras, often things are not organized in a proper fashion. Meaning you look through the Gemara, it's not so easy to find. It's not necessarily the case that if I'm looking for a Shaila Hilchos Shabbos that I'm going to find in a Masechta Shabbos. It might be somewhere else. So the Rambam decided, I have to take all the Gemaras, put them in order, figure out what the halacha is, and write it all down. This way, everything will be very clear for everyone. And the Rambam here writes, in his introduction, what the plan was for the writing, for the editing of the Rambam. So let's see here a number, hey. The Rambam writes in his introduction, the point is, Kedei shelo yehei adam tzarech lechiber achar ba'olam bedin medina Yisrael. That's a whopper of a statement, where the Rambam says, all you need is my book, and then you're good. You don't need anything else. Elo yehei chiber zem mekabetz letorah shebal peh kula, ima tarkanos v'aminhagos v'hagzerah shenasim imos Moshe Rabbeinu arachiber atalmud. I can tell you with certainty, says the Rambam, that I have consolidated, I have condensed everything from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu till today. You don't need a Gemara, you don't need anything. All you need to have is the Sefer of the Rambam. Lefikach, karasi, shem, chibur, zeh, Mishnah Torah. Therefore the Rambam says, I have referred to this as Mishnah Torah. That's a very courageous statement to make. Lefisha adam, kari batara shebeksav tchila. All you need to do is read the Psukim in Chumash. After that, you need to read my Sefer, v'yodea mimenu tarash abal peh kula, v'enu tzarech likro Sefer achar b'nehem. Says the Rambam, you can take everything else out of the way. You don't need any of the Rishonim, any of the Gemaras, no Midrashim. I've given you everything you need, and you are now set to be a God-fearing Jew who knows how to live life as an Orthodox practicing Jew in our community. Amazing. That's what the Rambam says. Now, it sounds very nice, but that alone infuriated and angered many of the Rambam's generation. And they said, how can the Rambam encourage people not to study the Gemara? The Gemara is the bedrock, it's the foundation of all that we practice, of all that we do. And who is the Rambam to say that we should now throw out the Gemara, get rid of all the Midrashim, and totally disregard everything that people used to learn, and now redirect everyone's attention to only learn the Sifrei HaRambam? That sounds a little bit extreme. And this was something that was very, very upsetting. It raised the ire of the members of the generation of the Rambam. So the Rambam actually addresses this point, and the Rambam says, I didn't mean that this should be a substitute, I didn't mean that this should be a replacement for the Gemara. What I meant is, Lemisha eno yachal leir la'oma katalmud. The Rambam says, for somebody who doesn't know how to learn a Gemara and fully understand it or appreciate it, or for somebody who doesn't have the time because they're busy doing other things, so I just made it simpler for them. And what I'm telling them is, all you need to do, if you only have a limited amount of time, is learn the Rambam every day. Which is why the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Livracha, came up with this campaign of learning the Rambam every day. It makes a lot of sense. Someone doesn't have a lot of time, and you're going to go through the Rambam, you will have a panoramic view of all the halacha that is ever relevant to you. It's very important. So that's something that the Rambam had in mind. Now, after the Rambam's passing, the debate did not end. There were people who were upset in the times of the Rambam, but the debate continued after the Rambam passed away. And there was an individual by the name of Reb Daniel HaBavli, who was very upset about what the Rambam had written, about many of the comments of the Rambam, and he found all kinds of inconsistencies in the Rambam, right? Every shir that you go to in halacha finds a steer in the Rambam. One place he says this, one place he says that. So we try to stand on our heads to figure out, oh, what did the Rambam mean? Did he mean A? Did he mean B? Did he mean C? What is it? But Reb Daniel HaBavli said, what are we standing on our heads? The Rambam's wrong. In one place he writes this, one place he writes that. He contradicts himself, it's totally inconsistent. And he sends letters upon letters to the son of the Rambam, Rabbeinu Avraham ben HaRambam, pointing out all the inconsistencies in his father's book. Now, I hate when people do that to me. It's not my problem. My father wrote something. Send him a letter. What are you sending me? I didn't write it. I'm not defending it. It's not my business. So, Rabbeinu Avraham ben HaRambam, like all good children do, feel the need that they still need to explain it. Even though it's not my job, but that's what I do. Rabbeinu Avraham ben HaRambam sends letters back explaining, no, my father meant this, my father meant that. He's answering up all the questions, and all this has been published. Then, as time went on, Reb Daniel HaBavli decided to take it a step further, and he prints an entire book attacking the Rambam and saying how everything in the Rambam is wrong, and we should not follow him, and this is a terrible idea that the Rambam wrote the Sefer, the Sedesvarim. And as a result of that, Reb Daniel HaBavli ends himself in Cheirem. He lands himself in a public cheirem, where they say that nobody is allowed to talk to him, nobody's allowed to do a business with him, nobody's allowed to be meshadech with him, and life becomes very difficult for him. So that's cheirem number one. That goes in the direction of those who were trying to attack the Rambam. Then, life continued to move on, and there were a number of Rishonim who finally dug up the manuscript of the Mor Nebuchim. Now the Rambam wrote the Mishneh Torah, which was all basic, very strict halacha. Then he wrote a sefer on philosophy called the Mor Nebuchim, and in the Mor Nebuchim you'll find that he has Greek philosophers that he quotes, and he quotes Aristotle, and he quotes all kinds of different things, and he has opinions about Tchias HaMeisim, Bias HaMashiach, and that really was something that made many of the Rishonim very uncomfortable. And they said, forgetting about our feelings about the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam, what about the fact that the Rambam here is saying things that are complete apikursos? So they were very upset. I'm sorry that I'm talking this way about the Rambam. It's not me. This is what the Rishonim wrote, that they were very, very opposed. Now, it's funny for us to hear such a thing because the Rambam is the Rambam, and we've accepted the Rambam as the most fundamental sefer in all of Jewish law. But yet, in the time, this was not something that was a given at all. So this was something that became a very, very heavy debate, to the point that in 1232... the Rishonim put a cheirem on the Sifrei HaRambam. The Rishonim said, no one's allowed to buy or sell or read or learn the Sfarim of the Rambam. It's amazing. So let's look at this over here. Look at number Vav, where they say, Im gam emes hadavar shahaya nizar b'chal mitzvah shabbat Torah, although you're telling me that it's true, and by the way, you know who led the charge against the Rambam at the time? Rabbeinu Yonah. You ever heard of Rabbeinu Yonah? The Shari Tshuva? One of the greatest Rishonim. Rabbeinu Yonah is the one that led the charge against the Rambam. And he writes, Although it's true that we hear that the Rambam was a very pious Jew and he kept all the mitzvahs, it's very nice. Halamatzinu, don't we find that there was a great Jew who was serving for 90 years as the Kohen Gadol, and in the end he became a tzaduki. In the end he went off the derech. So it's very nice that the Rambam was a good rabbi and that everybody appreciated him, but in the end of the day, he went off in the end of his life. Look what he wrote. After all, he wrote the Mor Nevuchim, and it must be that there's something off about the Rambam. The Ramban went berserk when he saw that. And the Ramban said, you want to argue in Hashkafa, you want to say you don't like this, you don't like that, you want to point out inconsistencies is one thing. But you think you're going to call the Rambam an Apikoros, you're going to call the Rambam like that Kohen Gadol who went off the derech after 90 years, and he said, this is taking it a little bit too far, and he was very, very pained and very upset, and this argument was going back and forth, until it got to a very extreme point. Look at number Zion where he says, "Vihine b'kinaseinu ba'ish avarnu dibarnu lechal akilos asher b'chal malchus irgun lehikal v'lamar anapsham lios yideim imanu lehilachem b'hem ulekadesh shema lehenu hamechulo b'neihem ulehaskim linadosem ulachrimam umekahal hagola lehibada me'ata v'yadolam." We are going to put all those people in Chayrim, and who are we putting in Chayrim? Rabbeinu Yonah. Why are we putting Rabbeinu Yonah in Chayrim? Because Rabbeinu Yonah is attacking the Rambam and telling everyone not to read the Rambam. So this was crazy. You think articles in the Five Towns Jewish Times are bad? This is one community is putting the other community in Chayrim. You have Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban, and look what's going on. And it happens to be they were related to each other. Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban were mechutanim. And they're fighting, and it's Leibedik. It's crazy. So this is what's going on. All over their feelings about what was going on with the Rambam's printing. Okay. Things went a little bit too far. And at some point, a letter was sent to the local government, and they were told that, you know, anytime you have a book that you're not happy with that's printed in secular culture, you burn it. You go into the public square and you burn it. So we'd appreciate if at the time that you were making a public burning of other books that you want to get rid of anyway, you can take all these copies of the Rambam and you can burn them in the public square. And that is what happened. That is what happened. That was the tragic story of the burnings of the Rambam. Rabbeinu Yonah himself, who was very opposed to the Rambam, felt that that was going way, way too far. To take the Rambams and burn them in the public square and have the non-Jews doing it, are you out of your mind? And Rabbeinu Yonah realized that this movement had gone way beyond where it should have been. In fact, Rabbeinu Yonah said, as a result of that, he believed that that's why in 1244, that's why the punishment for the Jewish community was that all the Gemaras were burnt, right? The non-Jews came and voluntarily burnt all the Gemaras. They weren't asked to do that. And he said that that was all an onesh min hashamayim, that was a punishment as a result of this terrible, terrible thing that they had done to burn all the Rambams. Anyway, this whole story was a big black stain on the Jewish community, and it was something that was going on for about 100 years, this fight back and forth about whether or not the Rambam's opinions and Svarim should be accepted. About 200 years later, in the early 1500s, there was a discussion about this once again. What is the validity of the Rambam, and should we accept the writings of the Rambam? And that's really where a lot of the issue, so far, none of this had to do with our Shir, but it's the background that's important to understand what it is that we're getting to. So, there was a great Jew by the name of the Maharam Padua. When he had his bris, his mother did not name him the Maharam Padua, obviously. His name was Rav Meir Katzenelenbogen. And he lived in the end of the 1400s, early 1500s. And he was one of the great Jews in Eastern Europe. And at the time, he was a little older than the Rama. The Rama was mid-1500s. The Rama was a student of all of these greats of that generation. So Rav Meir Katzenelenbogen was a great Jew. And at the time, he was very upset by what had happened over the years to the Sifrei HaRambam. And he felt that the time has come for us to restore the covenant of the Rambam. And we have to now come up with a printing of the Rambam. And he decided to take a lot of time to meticulously go through all of the Sifrei HaRambam. And he wrote comments on the bottom to explain all the inconsistencies that were pointed out over the years. And he tried to figure out, really, the Rambam, one of the problems in the Rambam is that he doesn't show us where he got everything from. The Rambam doesn't tell you what the source is and where he got the bottom line halacha that he's quoting. So the Maharam Padua tried to date back a lot of it to the Gemara, to the Midrashim. He tried to figure out where everything came from. And he spent a lot of time putting out an improved edition of the Rambam. Now, At the time, Jews were not allowed to print. In Italy, they did not have a right to use the printing options that were available. So since that was something that they weren't able to do, he decided, after working on this very hard, that he was going to send it to a Christian printer, whose name was, I forgot already, in the year 1550, Brigadini, something like that. The Acharonim quote the name of this person. And he sent it to this non-Jewish Christian, and he asked him, you know, I've worked on this manuscript, it's something that's going to be a bestseller, everyone's going to want it, because it's the new and improved set of the Rambam. He sends it to this printer, and he has it published. At the time, this Christian had another company that was always trying to get business for themselves. So he had two publishers, both of them always wanted to print a bestseller. So he decided, his competition was another Italian man who said that he's going to put out a cheaper edition of the Rambam. He said, oh, it must be that the Jewish community wants to buy Rambams, and if that's the case, he's going to put it out. That is what he did. And at the time, he said that he felt that the Maharam Padua's elucidation of the Rambam was incorrect. Now, who is he to say that it's incorrect? What does he know? So he said he got letters from the rabbis all over the world who told him that this is incoherent, doesn't make any sense, and he decided to go ahead with his own printing of the Rambam. Maharam Padua was devastated. Here he is. He worked years and years in his life to try to restore the covet of the Rambam and to try to sell a book that everyone was going to buy, and now the rug is taken out from under his feet. Another publisher goes ahead and prints a cheaper edition of the Rambam. Nobody really understands the difference between this and that. They don't really see when they're looking in the stores, oh, these comments, those comments. So he was very, very upset, and he went to none other than the Rama. The Rama at the time was only 20 years old. He was the Rav in Krakow, and he went to the Rama and he said, can you paskin the Shaila? What are we supposed to do? I printed the Rambam first, and I worked years and years to come up with this beautiful edition of the Rambam, and now somebody came and stole the thunder. Somebody came and reprinted the Rambam on their own and are selling it for much cheaper. So the Rama, at the time, put a cherem, here we go again with the cherems, he put a cherem on the edition, the second edition that came out. And he said that we have every obligation to buy the edition of the Rambam that was put together by the Maharam Padua, and we cannot buy this edition of the Rambam that was put out by the second publisher who was trying to outdo him. Now, at the time, as a result of this major controversy, the Rama writes a long tshuva about it, but at the time there was a major takana that was made, and that is that no one's ever allowed to print a sefer again without having a haskam. That was something that was new. Why did that happen? Because now, if you're going to have to get a haskama to your sefer, so how are you going to get a haskama if you're doing something illegal? No recognized rabbi is going to write you a haskama. So from that time on, they made up amongst themselves, they made a takana. No one's allowed to publish a book without having a haskama from somebody who's recognized. Now, it's not such a big deal today. You can get a haskama from anyone for anything. So it doesn't really mean that much, but it used to mean something that was significant, and that was really put in place in order to stop situations like this from happening. So the Rama has a long tshuva to explain why he feels that the Maharam Padua's edition needs to be bought, and why no one would be allowed to buy the second edition. And he goes through a number of arguments. One of the arguments that he makes, let's look here, number Ches, and he says that we have an obligation to patronize the Jew who is selling the book. Now the Maharam Padua is the Jew who invested all of his time. The second one is just a non-Jewish publisher who is trying to make money off the Rambam. So he says, we have an obligation to patronize the Jewish book that was published and printed by a Jew and invested by a Jew, as opposed to going to the non-Jew who's also selling a copy of the Rambam. And he says here, Ve'ein lomar, and don't say, Dizeu davka kishakusi v'Yisrael nosnim be'erach uvimekach echad. Don't tell me that the only time I have an obligation to patronize a Jew over a non-Jew is when they're selling for the same amount of money and they're selling the same product. Not true. Aval kashakusi mozil tvei, if the non-Jew is going to sell it at a cheaper rate, shari likach mimenu kedei la'arviach memekcho, maybe I'd be allowed to buy it from him because I want to save a few dollars. Right? So I have an option. I can go to Costco, or I can go to Gourmet Glad or Seasons. So what should I do? Why is there no poor Jew?
Seasons poor, is Gourmet
Glad. I don't know their finances. I have no idea, right?
They're not selling at the same
price. Oh, so they're not selling the same price. So you're saying, if I can go to Costco and buy wholesale price, why should I go to Gourmet Glad or Seasons at my retail? Look at the Rama here. What does the Rama say? Don't say that I should patronize the Jew only when it's the same price. Don't worry, we're going to get there in a minute. But the Ramah says, you have an obligation to patronize the Jew even when it's at a higher rate. How do you know? Because after all, the Gemara teaches us, if I have $50,000, is what we started with. I have $50,000 to loan to someone. I can either loan it to a non-Jew and make back the ribis, so I'll get $60,000 in return. Or I can give it to a Jew who's here and only get $50,000 back. Which one should I do? Says the Gemara, you have to give it to the Jew. What do you mean I have to give it to the Jew? I'm going to lose money that way. Okay, but I have to be willing to lose money for the sake of doing business with a Jew. So shouldn't the same be over here? If I have two options of where to buy the Rambam, I can buy either the Maram Padua's Rambam, which he worked very hard at, and he invested his time and effort and energy and money to publish, or I can go to the second publisher, who's a non-Jew, and buy his set of the Rambam for cheaper. Says the Ramah, if you don't want to buy a Rambam at all, so don't buy a Rambam. But if you're going to buy a Rambam, you have to buy this one. And the Ramah puts the second edition of the Rambam in Chayrim, not because he doesn't like the Rambam, but to the contrary, because he likes the Maram Padua, and he says we have an obligation to patronize him. So much so, he says, forgetting about the fact that we should be patronizing a Jew over a non-Jew, we certainly should be taking care of the Maram Padua. After all, he's one of the leaders of our generation, so we're just going to leave him high and dry. He spent years of his life trying to elucidate the Rambam, and now we're just going to leave him and not sell any of his copies. So the Ramah here writes a very long explanation of what he thinks would be the appropriate thing to do. Now, just hold on to your question for a minute. What? Right.
The other guy stole it and printed it.
No, so he didn't steal the Maram Padua's. He found the manuscript of the Rambam.
He did the original.
He did the original Rambam, and he wrote some small footnotes on the bottom that were good enough. Now, the average person who looks at it doesn't understand the difference between these footnotes and those footnotes. They say, oh, it's an elucidated Rambam, wonderful, I'll buy it. So he didn't steal it. He took the original manuscript of the Rambam, and he printed it. Now, the Chafetz Chaim qualifies this in the Sefer Avos Chesed, and he says, if I'm a provider, I run a business, and I have an item that I'd like to sell, I have a house that I want to sell, I have a car that I want to sell, whatever it might be. So says the Chafetz Chaim, it's true that the sources here that we've learned tell us that we have an obligation to prefer a Jewish buyer over a non-Jew. However, the Chafetz Chaim says, that's only the case when both of them walk into the store, when both of them come and make an offer. But says the Chafetz Chaim, let's say I put my house on the market, and a non-Jew comes along and makes a bid. I should wait around? Maybe a Jew is going to come around? Of course not. The Chafetz Chaim says, the whole discussion that we're having here is only if I have two potential buyers, both of them are interested, both of them are erlich, both of them are honest, and I have the opportunity to sell to A or to sell to B, the Medrash says, and that's what all these Rishonim are quoting, that's where the Ramah said you should choose A over B because A is Jewish and B is not. However, if I'm just going to be waiting around, if I have a store and somebody walks in and he says, I want to buy this item, I have to say, one second, you're not a Jew? I have to wait a month to see. Maybe a Jew is going to come in the next month and he's going to want to buy it, so I have to prefer him. Can't be, says the Chafetz Chaim. We have to do business, and part of business is, if I have merchandise, I want to get rid of it. I want someone to buy the first come, first serve. I don't have to wait around for someone to come later. But the whole discussion that we're having is when I have two people who are coming together. Now, what if I'm the consumer? I'm not the one who's the provider. I'm the consumer. And there are many options of where I can shop. As we mentioned, I can go to Costco and get it at wholesale price, which is obviously not owned by a Jew. Or I can go to Gourmet Glatter Seasons, which is going to be retail price, and it is owned by a Jew. So do I have an obligation to go only to the Jewish-owned store, or perhaps not? That is a very important question. And the Chafetz Chaim writes that when I know that there is a major, major discrepancy between the amount of money that I'm going to have to pay in the non-Jewish store and the amount of money that I'm going to have to pay in the Jewish store, in a situation like that, he says, of course, you'd be allowed to shop by the non-Jew. Again, is it a nice thing to shop by the Jew if he needs it? Of course. But he says, if I know that I'm getting ripped off in the Jewish store and it's not comparable at all to the amount of money that I would have to pay in the non-Jewish establishment, so that would be a situation where I would be allowed to shop by the non-Jew. The Maharam Shik has an interesting tshuva. The Maharam Shik was one of the great Gedolim in the 1800s, one of the great Gedolim of Hungary. He was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer. So he writes, what would happen if a person finds that the prices are the same in both locations, right? So let's say Costco and Gourmet Glatt were the same. They're not, but let's say they were. So let's say I had a Keyfood and Gourmet Glatt were the same. So it so happens that I live next door to Keyfood, And Gor Miglad is 5 minute drive. So I can either go next door and buy whatever I need, or I can drive in my car. Now, driving in the car is not the biggest deal, but what would he say? Would I have an obligation to be matshriach myself? So it's not going to cost me more money. Chafetz Chaim says, if I'm going to lose a lot of money, so then I don't have to. Now, by the way, what does a lot of money mean? That's very subjective. You know, this is something in halacha that is discussed. Every so often you have in halacha that b'makom hefsid meruba, we would allow somebody to do something differently. Doesn't mean you're allowed to break the law, but it means that perhaps in Meruba, very specific situations. For example, the Gemara says somebody is traveling and they have a, and now it's Leil Shabbos. So they're traveling and they have to stop for Shabbos. But they have a bunch of packages on the animal's back. So they have to take it off. And how are they going to take it off? If they take it off, it's going to break. It's very fragile material. So the Gemara says you're allowed to do muktzah things, you're allowed to do certain things in order that b'makom hefsid meruba, it shouldn't get ruined. Now, how do you calculate a hefsid meruba? This is a question that Rabbi Akiva Eiger asked in a tshuva. How do you calculate hefsid meruba? If I have 100 vases on the back of that animal, each vase costs $10. So one vase is going to break. It's not a hefsid meruba. It's not a loss of a lot of money. It's $10. I've wasted $10 on lots of other things in my life. If I look at the whole package together, it's 1,000 vases, and if I don't take it down carefully, they're all going to break. That's a hefsid meruba. So do I look at each individual item, or do I look at the whole thing? That's relevant to our discussion here. When I'm talking about a potential hefsid meruba by shopping by the Jew as opposed to the non-Jew. So every time I go to Gor Miglad, I'm paying an extra $10 for my shopping order than I would pay had I gone to Costco, let's say. But if I take that over the course of a year, not just a one-time shopping, if I take that over the course of a year, it's going to be $1,000. That's a hefsid meruba. That's a lot of money. If it's $10 that I'm looking at, so you say, okay, so for $10, help out the Jew. But don't look at the $10. Look at the entire perspective. Look at the fact that over the course of a year, it's not going to be $10, it's going to be thousands of dollars. In a situation like that, that's what the Chafetz Chaim says, I wouldn't be obligated to go and patronize the Jewish store. However, the Maharam Shik says, what if they're selling at the same price, at the same rate? Just one of them is very convenient for me, it's right next door to my house, and the other one happens to be a few minutes drive away. So do I have an obligation to be matriach myself to go and spend the money and patronize the Jewish store as opposed to the non-Jewish store that's next door to me where I won't have to go out of my way? So the Maharam Shik discusses this. Let's see a number test where he says, Amnam mishum tircha de trichale milsa yoser liknos me yisrael me'etzal anachri. If it's simply going to be something that is going to inconvenience me by getting in the car and driving to the other store, lo shamanu, he says, we've never heard that that should be allowed. Kivin da'al yado yavo hanali Yisrael. Nuv, get in the car and help the Jew. What's your problem? You're so worried about your 5 minutes? Get in your car and go help the Jew, patronize the Jew. V'chi milsa zutra sahi lehenos v'lachio says Yisrael. You're so worried about yourself. Do you not realize how important it is to try to help another person, to help another Jew? So in a situation like that, he says, I don't understand why you would have a heter to go to the store next door as opposed to going to the Gor Miglad down the block. The Achronim do not accept this at all. And the Maharsham and other Achronim say, how can that be? After all, we all know that people will pay money for convenience, right? Look at Gor Miglad. Gor Miglad charges, I think, $10 if you want to have an order sent to your house. Something like that? No? What? 11? 10, right? It costs money. So you ask yourself, why am I paying $10? I can just as easily get in my car and go shopping in Gor Miglad. No, because my time is worth something. So it's not worth it for me to roam around the store. Actually, when I go to the store, it takes me 3 times as long because I stop and talk to everyone in the aisles. I can't find anything I need. So, you know, it is worth something to me. So maybe the $10 is worth it for me. Says the Maharsham, we all know that it's not a simple equation. Oh, I have one store next door to me and a store down the block, so just go to the store down the block and get in your car, spend another 5 minutes. No, my 5 minutes is valuable. I can be doing something else. And we all know that we're willing to pay for conveniences in our lives, right? How many people here on Hanukkah buy the ready-made candles? Why, you can't do it with your hands? Of course you can. It's just a pain in the neck. So why should I do it? Yeah, does it cost $35 instead of $10 to buy the pre-made? Yeah, of course it does. Is it worth it? I would say it's worth it. That's why I do it. Some people say it's not worth it, so they wouldn't. Says the Maharsham, we all pay for certain conveniences in our lives, right? I buy the Czech lettuce. How many people buy the Czech lettuce? Not everybody. Some people say, no, we should sit there and look through it and wash it. Some people say, don't wash it at all. Just eat it with the bugs. So that's not an option, right? So the option is, you're either going to sit there and spend your time washing it, or you're going to spend $7 for a small bag of lettuce, and you're actually going to have to spend extra money for that convenience. You know what? Some people would say, spending the money on that convenience is worth it, because I don't want to sit over the sink and the light box and look through the lettuce to see if there are bugs in it. Says the Maharsham, you have to think about this in real life. In a real life situation, would I say that a person has an obligation to do something when it's inconvenient in order to help out another Jew? Rav Moshe clearly says that he thinks that there would not be an obligation to inconvenience myself. Rav Moshe writes in a tshuva, well, when we're saying that for a hefsid muat, for a small discrepancy, I would be obligated to patronize a Jewish store as opposed to a non-Jew. Rav Moshe says the truth is that that is a very loosely defined term. For me, a hefsid merubah will be different than for somebody who's a hotshot lawyer and making $1 million a year. A hefsid merubah for him is very different than it is for me. And that's the way it is. We all have a different definition of what a big loss is and what a small loss is. Look, you have somebody who's very wealthy, who's willing to invest money in the stock market. No, they lose $100,000 this year, it's okay. Why? Because last year they made $1 million. So for them, $100,000 is not a hefsid merubah. For me, $100,000 is a major hefsid merubah. So it very much is dependent on the person. And Rav Moshe says over here, the bottom line is, when the Gemara tells us that I have an obligation to give the loan to the Jew as opposed to the non-Jew and to forego the opportunity to make back the ribbis, Rav Moshe says the understanding there is that we're talking about a small percentage. How much money are you going to make already when you loan the money on ribbis? Now, if it's a long-term loan, it's a lot of money. It's not a small amount. But he says, the understanding of the Gemara is, we're talking about a negligible amount of money, it's not so much money. So, if I have the opportunity to give it to a Jew as opposed to a non-Jew, and forego a couple of $100, a couple of $1,000 maybe, so Rav Moshe says maybe. But he says, if you're talking about more than that, if you're talking about a major discrepancy, if hiring the Jew is going to cost me this, and hiring the non-Jew is not going to cost me that, so that would be something that I would not have to take into consideration if it's a major discrepancy as far as the money is concerned. The Chasam Sofer adds one final point that we're going to discuss, and then we'll finish. Chasam Sofer says, when the Torah says, O kano miyad amisecha, and from there we learn that you're supposed to have a list of priorities, like the Gemara said, it should be an ani before an ashir, it should be aniye mishpachtecha before aniye ircha, it should be aniye ircha before aniye iracheres. All of these considerations that the Gemara says, he says, amisecha really means someone who is with you, and not just the Jew, but someone who is a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. And the Chasam Sofer says, in his opinion, on that list of priorities, we should also add that not just should I try to do the business or patronize or help or give a job to somebody who is a Jew as opposed to a non-Jew, but he says I should also try to give preferential treatment to somebody who is a Shomer Torah Mitzvos, because that really is Amisecha. And he quotes it from a Gemara Masechet Shavuos, where it says, B'tzedek tishpat Amisecha, and that's referring to somebody, the Gemara says, who is Imcha b'Torah v'mitzvah, somebody who is on the same kind of level as you in their observance of Torah mitzvah. So this is a very important halacha, very important sugya. Again, when we have the opportunity to hire workers or to give people a job, like the Rambam says, Ein lecha tzedakah gadol mizu. There's no greater way to show my charity than to give somebody a job and put them on their own two feet and allow them to take care of themselves and not have to rely on others. But when doing so, you have many, many different factors to keep in mind. And a lot of this comes from that very fundamental tshuva of the Rama, where the Rama lays down the law of what he believes was the right psak for the printing of the Rambam with the Maharam Padua, which I think is a fascinating area of history, an interesting study just to think about. But outside of that, this is something that can be very relevant in all of our lives, something that can come up all the time in where we shop and how we shop and who we choose to patronize and who we choose to buy and sell from. And we should try our best to help Achenu B'nai Yisrael as best as we can. Wishing everyone a wonderful day.